dead, as it were, there's this moment where something utterly romantic is held at the same time, as something utterly barbaric and ruined and bloody and bloodied. And how Gibbon holds both these things is how this book has force. He holds the lyrical and the real in the one hand and makes a kind of force of these two things. And after the war, what were you going to do? All the feelings you had and also the realities of it. That's what this book's about.
I mean, Jackie, there's also, it seems to me, a sense of disillusionment, simply because in the 1930s, when the book's published, Scotland, like the rest of Britain, of course, was going through the Great Depression. There's a feeling of a generation that had been betrayed. And one can in some ways read that back into the moral ambiguity at the end of the book. I mean, without wanting to give away too much of the plot, various of the characters do things, whether it's related to domestic violence, frankly, or behaviour in war, that make them quite ambiguous characters.
Yeah, so I think that's the other thing that I think is wonderful about Sunset Song, because he's not looking at people in a kind of one-dimensional way. Everybody in the book is complex. The interesting thing is the land is changing all the time, progress is coming, the machines are changing, and therefore the characters are changing all the time in the same kind of pace.
And Ali, even the landscape in the book seems to reflect that feeling of an end of an era, a watershed, you know, an elegiac feeling. There's particularly one scene where trees are described on the estate in a, you know, really very, very impressive and moving way. And I wonder if you might read that for us.
Che went round Auchinradi on his leave that time and found changes enough to open his eyes. Maybe he was fell wearied with the front folk, thought there was nothing on there but their pleatering and fighting. And the first change he saw the first morning did Che, lying down in his bed for the pleasure of it and Kirsty at the making of his breakfast. And Che sat up in his bed to reach for his pipe when he looked from the window and he gave a great roar and he louped from his bed in his sark so that Kirsty came running and crying, "What is't? Is't a wound?" But she found Che standing by the window then, cursing himself black in the face he was, and he asked, "How long had this been going on?" So Mistress Strachan looked out the way he looked, and she saw it was only the long bit wood that ran by the Peasy's Nap that vexed him. It was nearly down the whole stretch of it now. It made a guy difference to the lookout, faith, but fine for Kinraddy the woodmen had been. They'd lodged at the Nap and paid high for their board. But Che cried out, "To hell with their board, the bastards, they're ruining my land, do you hear?" And he pulled on his trousers and boots and would have fair run over the park and been at them, but Kirsty caught at his sark and held him back and cried, "Have you fair gone mad with the killing of Germans?" And he asked her, hadn't she got eyes in her head, the fool, not telling him before that the wood was cut? It would lay the whole Nap open to the northeast now and was fair the end of a living here.
Ali, it's a mark of a great novel, and this is clearly a great novel, that it is not confined within national boundaries. At the same time, we are living at the moment through a period when Scotland is looking at its own identity, and that's as true in culture as it is in everything else. Yeah. What do you think the continuing significance of Sunset Song is for Scotland today?
Scotland today and Sunset Song and Grasset Gibbon, it's all very... it's very close to what Grasset Gibbon was where he was politically when he was writing this book. There was a great weight on him to be a Scottish nationalist. There was a great weight on him to be a diffusionist. There was a great weight on this book to be a Marxist text. There was a great weight on Chris to be the land. There's a great weight on Chris to be Scotland herself. The book trails symbolisms after it like a lot of tin cans. Actually, this book outdoes all the trailing and all the symbolisms and all the isms, every ism there is. At every point, Gibbon dodges the ism, because when it comes down to it, he wants us to be human. Not even humanist, but human. And at every point when you come up against something where you think that there's a belief being forced at you or there's politics that, you know, that you're supposed to be listening to with an agenda, Gibbon outdoes it, makes it human, reminds you that there's a heartbeat in here.
And I think that the sun is going to have to set on our particular song at that moment. Oh. We've had a wonderful journey, so please do thank my guests today, Ali Smith and Jackie Kay.
Rana Mitter presented this evening's Proms Plus literary event, and the producer was Laura Thomas. Welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall from me, Martin Handley, for the second part of tonight's BBC Prom, live, of course, here on Radio 3, home of the Proms. The BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra is making its first visit of the 2012 season with its chief conductor, Donald Runnicles, performing works which, for him, are very much at the heart of his musical world. In the first half, it was Wagner. Now we hear from his disciple, Bruckner. He was 63 when he completed his 8th symphony and sent it to his supporter, the conductor, Hermann Levy. He, though, just couldn't grasp the symphony's scale, and he said it was unperformable. That devastated the always totally insecure composer, who spent the next 3 years revising it, changing the orchestration and rewriting the music from small details to whole sections. The whole piece is made up of what you might call symphonic waves, the accumulation of increasingly powerful climaxes, the very opening which starts hesitatingly before arching upwards and then falling away, demonstrates in miniature the musical tension and resolution of the whole piece. The scherzo comes second and contrasts swirling, implacable music with rest and tranquility. The vast slow movement seems to float timelessly, alternately searching and contemplative, one of Bruckner's very greatest pieces of writing. And the finale eventually brings it all together with complete inevitability in a moment of pure musical splendour. When I talked to Donald Ranicles after this morning's rehearsal, I asked him whether he agreed that in Bruckner's great symphonies you cover centuries of music in one go.
When I'm working with the orchestra, I do evoke Monteverdi, Bach, even further. I mean, the music that was so seminal to Anton Bruckner, the religious music, we're talking about Vittoria, we're talking about Lassus, Palestrina. The spectres of these composers are still very much within this work, and for me it's extremely rewarding, even when it comes to phrasing or the actual orchestral sonority, just by mentioning sometimes these composers, because this was very much where Anton Bruckner came. I mean, his supreme command of counterpoint was through weeks, months of studying all, whether it was Bach, whether it was etc. So, yes, I do think in this vast and epic journey, he invokes and evokes many other composers of a bygone era. And I think that's what for me is so rewarding and what is so fulfilling about performing this music. And this is music that is very much not of our time, in the sense that everybody's in a hurry. It's hustle bustle. And for me, this music is like some luxurious massage. And that sounds terribly glib, but somehow it brings your pulse down. Everything slows down. You have fun in reflecting. And one talks about needing patience to listen to Anton Bruckner. But in a way, I think people back then listened to music in a very different way than we do today. With this symphony, he perfected the finale. I feel he has absolutely got this right. And it's a phenomenal journey, but I do think that just the dimensions of those movements are perfect.
Donald Ranicles, who was also talking to me about Bruckner the organist and how the orchestra is like having a fabulous 8-manual organ with a 64-foot pedal. Ranicles himself is an organist. He often used to deputise for his father in an Edinburgh church. And he does say that Bruckner's life in the organ loft certainly infuses this piece. And he thinks of the pacing, letting the sound in the cathedral, the ideal Royal Albert Hall, have time to clear between each section. And of course, Bruckner gave one of the opening recitals on the organ towering above us here in the hall back in 1871. So in a way, his spirit resides in this hall ahead of us hearing his 8th symphony. Here comes Donald Ranicles onto the platform, joining the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra to perform Bruckner's 8th symphony. think I can say that Donald Runicles liked the way his orchestra played that. You just look at them in admiration at the end of that performance of Bruckner's Symphony No. 8 in C minor here in the Royal Albert Hall. The BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra, guest led by David Adams, conducted by Donald Runicles. The symphony was dedicated to the Austro-Hungarian Emperor, Franz Josef, who paid for its publication. And after the triumphant first performance in Vienna in 1892, when the conductor Hans Richter left the hall by the stage door, there was Bruckner waiting for him with a tray of 48 hot donuts. Practical. Well, the Scottish Symphony Orchestra aren't going far away. They'll be back here on Sunday with the National Youth Orchestra of Scotland and Donald Runicles, Nicola Benedetti, the soloist in Brooks, Scottish Fantasy, premieres by James McMillan and Thea Musgrave, as well as pieces by Wagner again, Richard Strauss, ending with Respighi's Hymns of Rome. All the wind principals being brought to their feet by Donald Runicles. David Flack, principal horn, you... Sterling job. If we'd been elsewhere in Europe, it would have been a complete change of horn section, you suspect, but here with the Scottish Symphony Orchestra, they all play everything. That's the Wagner tubas. They'll all be going up to Edinburgh, Donald Runicle's hometown, of course, for the festival. He's got a very busy August going off to his festival in Wyoming, and then back to the Deutsche Oper in Berlin, where he's music director for Parsifal. The heavy brass being brought to their feet. Don't forget, if you've just come in, you've been watching the Olympics, you've missed some of tonight's performance, or you just want to hear it again, have that slow massage Donald Runicles was talking about, then of course you can always go on iPlayer for the next week and hear it again. Well, as Donald Runicles brings the entire BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra to its feet, and with that glorious ending ringing in my ears, I'm off to make my way across Hyde Park to Broadcasting House to finish working on tomorrow morning's Radio 3 breakfast show. I hope very much you'll join me anytime from 7 to start your weekend with Radio 3. But for now, time for me to hand you on from an exhilarated Albert Hall to Jonathan Swain, who's waiting to host the rest of your evening. Jonathan.
Martin, thank you. Don't work too late tonight. Martin Handy there with tonight's live prom, and as well as the iPlayer he mentioned, just to add, there's another chance to hear that prom broadcast here on BBC Radio 3 on Monday week at 2 in the afternoon. As for proms as they happen, there's more Bruckner on Tuesday night.
On Radio 3 from the BBC Proms, Bruckner's Sixth Symphony. The BBC Philharmonic and its new principal conductor, Juanjo Mena, fresh from an acclaimed proms debut earlier in the season. And the world premiere of a new work by a composer closely associated with the orchestra, James McMillan. Tuesday night, BBC Radio 3 at 7:30.
Yes, it should be good. You may have caught Juanjo Mena's Bruckner Sixth Symphony with the BBC Philharmonic in a Radio 3 live in concert just a few weeks ago. As David Fanning wrote afterwards in the Telegraph, rarely have I heard a Bruckner Sixth that displayed such masterful long-term vision, and never, I think, one that made the work seem so important. Well, the BBC Phil's prom opens with Wagner's Tristan Prelude, followed by James McMillan's Credo with the Bruckner Sixth Symphony in the second half. That's next Tuesday night, live from the Royal Albert Hall here on BBC Radio 3, home of the BBC Proms, starting at 7:30. As for tomorrow, we've two visits to the Albert Hall. The first prom in the afternoon, the Ulster Orchestra and the Ulster Youth Orchestra, conducted by Joanne Folletta, in music by Chabrier, Stravinsky's The Firebird, and one of the Mozart flute concertos with flautist James Galway, no less. 2 o'clock tomorrow afternoon for that. Well, back to tonight, and in 5 minutes' time, Out in the World, A Global Gay History. Richard Coles continues his study of same-sex desire across the centuries. For the moment, Bach via Villa-Lobos, his arrangement for 8 cellos, of one of the preludes from the Well-Tempered Clavier. The players are the Pleath Cello Octet. Prelude in D minor, Villa-Lobos's arrangement for cello octet of the Prelude No. 8 in E-flat minor from Book 1 of Bach's 48 Preludes and Fugues, and it was played there by the Pleath Cello Octet. This is BBC Radio 3. It's 1 minute past 10, and now the last in our series, first broadcast last year, Out in the World, A Global Gay History. In this, the fourth programme, presenter Richard Coles looks at the extraordinary shifts and changes in attitude to same-sex relationships in the recent past and how those changes are playing out across the world. But he begins very much at home.
The parish church of St Mary the Virgin, Findon, a very beautiful building, built from about 1300 to 1350, and it's where I'm parish priest, the 59th person to have the honour. Two of my ancestors were vicars here also in the early 17th century, so you might think I'm to the manor born, but I'm not. It may surprise you that an Anglican country parson should be one of the children of the revolution, but I am.
Say you want a revolution, well, you know.
It looked like the crowd had the upper hand because there weren't enough police. It was maybe 6, 10 police. It was the most I could see around once the cars pulled away. So they were cornered, the police, up against the doorway.
Well, that's when all hell broke loose at that point. And then we had to get back into the Stonewall.
The family does need protection in Britain today. And as far as I'm concerned, it's going to get it.
No one is going to tell me that male homosexuals who engage in the act of sodomy are doing what anyone can reasonably support or accept or condone.
In chronological order, you heard eyewitness accounts of the Stonewall riots in New York in June 1969, which heralded a new militancy among gay people, both in the States and across the Western world. The then British Conservative MP Jill, now Baroness Knight, speaking out against that movement during the Clause 28 debate of the mid-80s, which sought to limit the availability in schools of gay-friendly material. And from 1988, the thoughts of James Anderton during his time as Chief Constable of Greater Manchester. Well, since then, things have moved on and continue to move. From June this year, Republican State Senator Stephen Salland, after he voted in favour of gay marriage in the New York State Senate.
I can say that my intellectual and emotional journey has ended here today, and I have to define doing the right thing as treating all persons with equality, and that equality includes within the definition of marriage.
These are all mere episodes in a much bigger story, a story of fierce argument and debate, march and countermarch. And they say nothing either of the huge agony of HIV/AIDS, which must have seemed the answer to a prayer for the many who wanted gay rights to be rolled back, not only in the West, but all over the world. This series has concentrated, as far as evidence will allow, on same-sex relationships through history. In this final programme, I want to look at the recent past and try to understand the divide that's developed between Western reformers and those who oppose them, some fiercely and implacably, some uneasy at the speed of change in attitudes towards sexuality and human rights.
Searching their houses, calling them queer. I don't believe that sort of thing happens here.
A prominent figure in the gay rights movement since the early 1980s is Peter Tatchell. I've known him for much of that period, and I wanted to find out what he makes of the relationship between our contemporary debate about rights and sexuality and the longer story we've been exploring during this series.
I think it'd be very mistaken to try and reclaim homosexuality and gay identity back in history because, of course, in other historical epochs and moments, the same-sex behaviour was very different. Homosexuality itself has gone through a process of evolution, and with that evolution has emerged gay, lesbian, bisexual and transgender identities.
And yet I find from that historical record, you occasionally hear a voice or read a report of a voice which sounds
heartbreakingly modern. I'm thinking of court reports, which I've read of, in the 17th century in Italy, I think, in which someone talked about their desire as being normal. I'm just the same as you, he says, as the poor guy's carried off to a grisly fate. There is a sense in which same-sex relationships in history are not always simply about acts. They're sometimes reported as so, because often it's just forensic. But you do get a sense that these are people who have tenderness, feeling, love, commitment to each other.
That's undoubtedly true. And you can probably trace it back much earlier than the 18th century in Italy or other parts of Europe. But I think the notion, the modern notion, of someone identifying themselves as gay is a fairly recent phenomenon.
Why do you think it is such a key issue in our time? Or indeed, do you think it is a key issue in our time?
Gay people are the canaries in the mine. We can judge a society's commitment to equality, liberty and human rights by the way it treats its gay people. Societies that persecute lesbian, gay, bisexual and transgender people tend to be very authoritarian ones who also persecute other citizens. The fact that LGBT people are organising, not just in Western countries but all over the world today, is proof of a parallel rise of human rights culture, the idea that equality is a universal, and our struggle is symptomatic of that very broad struggle which is taking place in all different countries and cultures right across the world.
How do you think we're doing?
Who's the we?
I mean the we. I mean you and me. People of a certain age, half a century through our lives, who've grown up in metropolitan areas in the sort of places where gay rights was a live and current issue and continues to be.
Our lives have been utterly transformed in a mere four decades. When I was growing up, homosexuality was totally illegal, punishable by life imprisonment. The courts could sentence you to forcible psychiatric treatment, including electric shock aversion therapy, supposedly to cure your homosexuality. I personally was attacked and beaten up. I was refused jobs, I was refused accommodation, simply because I was gay. And that's the experience of many other lesbian, gay and bisexual people of our generation. So this last four decades has been an absolutely momentous period of social history.
Peter Tatchell. So how is that canary in the mine sounding in the internet age? Given that we started this series among the tombs of the ancient Egyptians and found even there strong indications of same-sex relations 5,000 years ago, it seemed right to ask that question in Egypt, now, at the beginning of the Arab Spring. I'm in a car driving through Cairo, incredibly impressive city, very vivid, very dynamic, huge, 20 million people. And there's this sense now, as well, on this side of the Egyptian revolution, of a new atmosphere that people are breathing, a new hope for a more settled democracy and greater freedoms. To say against that, not so long ago, about 10 years ago, there was a notorious trial here in Egypt when the police raided a gay club, rounded up the people there, about 50 of them, and tried them for an offence which translates to something like public debauchery. Half of them were convicted and some sentenced to 5 years with hard labour. A lot of people saw that as a hardening of attitudes towards homosexuality. I wonder if that's going to change in the new dispensation as it emerges. Some think it will. Others have expressed concern that there are conservative forces to the revolution too. Well, to test that, I'm going off to see a young writer who, not long after that trial, made a big splash in Egypt by publishing what's been described as the first Egyptian gay novel. Mustafa Fati invited me to meet him at his central Cairo office. Just going into a building now, just out down a side street. An old building, 19th century, cool inside. Pillars, steps, and there's two guys just came running out, one carrying a camera and a tripod, and another one carrying a flight case. So I guess we're approaching a centre of media operations. Mustafa's main job is running his internet radio station, Radio Horietna. The large poster of Martin Luther King in the office tells you something about its values. But it was for his novel, In the Country of Boys, that he ran into serious trouble, even before its publication.
What I want to say from my book is anyone in the Egyptian society have the right to live. And there is no gods in the land. You are just human. When you tell someone you are a homo in the Egyptian society, the first step, he will refuse you. The next step, he will say a lot of bad words about you. You are not a man. He is a bad guy. I have an example. A friend of mine, he is a gay from Upper Egypt. Now he lives in Cairo. He told his mother that he is a gay. She told him, go to Cairo, don't live in Upper Egypt. Your father will kill you. Please go now.
And that was that?
Yes.
Yeah. Do you think the Egyptian revolution, in contrast, might be good, change the situation favorably for gay people in Egypt?
Actually, I hope so.
What happened in Egypt in the last 9 months, starting from the 25th of January, till the moment, LGBTIQ individuals were everywhere.
Egyptian activist Khulod Bidak insists debate about sexuality should not be seen as a mere side issue in the Egyptian uprising. She and her colleagues were, she says, in the thick of it.
And the front lines and the Bloody Wednesday and the day of the Israeli embassy. I mean, you just name it. We were everywhere, and not only in the street, online and maybe sometimes on the TV to talk about rights in general or to discuss something political. I just wanted to let others know that we are everywhere and we will be everywhere. Now, the street is accepting more people. Now it's easy for us to be in the street. A year ago, even if we were visible, we're still for the street invisible. They would never notice us. But I think now people could a little bit recognize us. I feel all right. I usually get attacked in the street as a gay guy, not as a lesbian, which didn't happen for a while now. But I'm grateful.
The society that Khulod inhabits and Mustafa describes reminds us perhaps of post-war Britain. Homosexuality manifestly existed, but it was the report of the Wolfenden Committee in 1957 and the legislation that followed 10 years later, decriminalising homosexual behaviour between consenting adults, that was the game changer. Dr. Matt Holbrook, however, cautions against using Wolfenden as a blueprint for international reform. It was, he says, a very British sort of affair.
The whole rhetoric of the respectable homosexual that drives the deliberations of Wolfenden is a homosexual. It's a model of sexual behaviour or a kind of a sexual identity that is shaped in the image of elite men. That's done, I suppose, at the level of assumption and rhetoric. It's also done in practical terms because the homosexual men who have the opportunity to testify to Wolfenden are all from very, very specific elite social worlds. And the arguments that they make to Wolfenden and the identity that they demand decriminalisation or demand rights for is very much shaped in their own image. It's sort of private, it's discreet, in a way a kind of an invisible sexual identity. It reflects the sort of the privacy and the discretion that are then being invested in middle-class marriage.
Even if the Wolfenden Report and the subsequent Sexual Offences Act of 1967 are particular to One Nation story, we weren't the only countries to change the law. Our tour brings us next to India, where, as we heard last week, Section 377 of the Indian Penal Code criminalising homosexual activity as against the order of nature was overturned by the High Court in Delhi as recently as 2009.
The law criminalising homosexuality dates back to the 1860s and British rule. That's why for gay rights campaigners here, it's a colonial relic. Getting rid of it is a sign that India is a modern, dynamic nation where all are included.
I mean, it's not a marriage law. It's just about whether sodomy is a crime or not. So it's high time now, you know, that we overturn this law once and for all.
Nitin Karani, who's been involved in the Indian gay rights movement for the last 15 years. As in Egypt, Nitin is concerned with the local perspective here, and for the moment, the High Court verdict is the focus.
There is a general sense of confidence. People are much more willing to come out at a gay event, at least, without fear of that party being raided or that get-together being raided or maybe even attacked by hoodlums. I think that confidence is there. To an extent, people are also coming out that to their friends at the workplace maybe. Beyond that, I'm not saying that the verdict has changed attitudes of society itself. What I'm saying is that there has been a debate around it at least. It's there on the front page, it's there on television. If the moment you switch on television, there's no way you can avoid it. It's not just in some random talk show. There has been a little bit of more opening of minds, I think, to some extent. Not completely. We still have a health minister who goes around saying on a forum saying that this is a Western disease. This is abnormal. This is denigration of Indian culture. What is so-called Indian culture? I mean, how much do we even know about our own culture, about our own religious textbooks? They're not quoting anything to say that this is against it.
Anger at the appropriation of a national history and culture, and the assumption that attitudes to sexuality, and indeed the discussion of sexuality, is a Western phenomenon, are issues we've touched on before. But the prevalence of television debate about homosexual identity, you might call it the Oprah effect, is certainly marked. And with it comes a Western tendency, perhaps, to take a lead not from politicians, but celebrities, which in India means someone from the worlds of either Bollywood or cricket.
The sooner someone comes out, the better it is for us. But whether it'll happen, I'm very skeptical. At least I wish a cricketer would come out, because I think maybe that would be seen in a more positive light, because there might still be people who will criticize somebody from Bollywood coming out. People in cricket might still be seen as real achievers.
It's a nice distinction. Who are the real achievers in any society? In Western Europe in the 80s, Nitin Kalani's hopes were anticipated by the list of high-profile celebrities coming out, or indeed being forced out. This has always been a contentious area in which the greater good argument clashes with the right to privacy.
The problem is that we don't have anybody who's actually out in Greece. There are no celebrities, no artists. I can only name one, really, the choreographer who was behind the opening closing ceremonies of the Olympic Games, the Athens Olympic Games.
I spoke to Leo Kalavirnas at a cafe in the Gazia district of Athens, on the edge of a smarter bohemian quarter, now taken over by fashionable bars and restaurants. You can sense the difference between what's happening here and in India or Egypt from Leo's frustration. Feisty, impatient rather than resigned, but still looking for high-profile support.
Even though we have lesbian and gay MPs, they're not out. We had mayors who were gay, they were not out. We have tons of artists, singers, actors and actresses that are gay, but they're not out. They actually go out of the way to prove that they're straight, which is a bit ridiculous because everybody knows they're gay. And there's a kind of silence conspiracy by media that do not ask questions.
In that sense, it seems like life in Athens, life in Greece is 10, 15 years behind the rest of Europe.
It is indeed, right. There's a lot of homophobia. Still, even in this area, there have been attacks, there's been gay bashing, which are not reported, really.
The Gazia district of Athens seems very similar to other boho enclaves in European cities. It's the domestic scene in modern Greece that Leo finds most frustrating.
My parents know I'm gay since I was 17. I've embraced all my boyfriends, we've gone on holiday together, they ring him up and ask about me and buy him underwear for his birthday, but they will not allow me to actually use the words and talk about it. This is the overall rule in Greece. We can do practically whatever we want as long as we don't rock the boat, as long as the neighbours think we're a decent, self-respecting family. The biggest problem, the biggest enemy for gays in Greece is us, our own selves. As long as we don't accept ourselves, I don't want to paint a bleak picture about gay rights in Greece, because things are getting better. It's just that it's a slow process, and we tend to compare ourselves with other Western societies, and the comparison is always to our detriment. But that doesn't mean we should lose heart. And on the contrary, we should see where we started and how bad things were back then, and how far we've already
The language I hear talking to people during the making of these programmes is that of journey. It's full of the idea of purpose, forward movement, the attainment of goals, and assumes perhaps the desirability of both itinerary and outcome. Worth taking a look at that. But before we do, let's take one more step along the road.
If you had told me in my lifetime that I would be able to register as a domestic partner with Stephen in the state of California, that would happen, I would be absolutely stunned.
Craig Davidson is a New Yorker who lives with his British partner Stephen Bottrell in San Francisco. But their civil partnership, not marriage, was formed in Britain.
I was in New York when the Stonewall happened. I was in Manhattan. So I've seen these changes happening, and I know they're happening rapidly. And I know the next generation of voters that are coming out, to them, this is a question of, I don't get it. You know, why aren't gay marriages allowed? So I do think that in my lifetime now, I am going to see gay marriage as nationally accepted in the United States. You know, we have, for all intent and purposes, a marriage through domestic partnership, and yet we don't. We don't have anything near a marriage.
As far as the federal government is concerned, of course, Craig and I have been roommates and strangers for the last almost 20 years, because at the federal level, the thing is not recognized at all. In a way, we're more married in Britain than we are in California. We're more married in California than we are in Wyoming. And it's an odd feeling going from place to place and feeling your relationship or the change, as it were, or at least the externals of it can, in certain circumstances, change.
I get off the plane in London and immediately I feel married in every sense of the word married.
Part of the difference... Sorry, we interrupt each other as... Well, you know, long-time couples do. Part of the difference is that in Britain, we were married in a registry office with a crowd of people and friends and family and flowers, and it was exactly the same as if we'd been a heterosexual couple. In California, we filled out a form and sent it into the Secretary of State's office. And there's something to do with the ritual and the public celebration of it that surrounds it. And although the legal distinctions may be what they are, and they may be rather fine distinctions, I mean, there is a sense in which having got married in Britain, formed a civil union, as it were, as the legal term, I think, in Britain, it does make you feel somehow more married than we do back home.
But campaigners like Peter Tatchell are quick to point out that those legal distinctions are very much in place in Britain. Stephen and Craig are not officially married, even if they look and feel like they are. And Stephen has a sense that debates about civil partnerships or gay marriage can sound very esoteric in the global context.
The early stage of the history of gay and lesbian people as a self-conscious minority may be coming to an end, and it may be moving towards a different and no doubt equally interesting stage in future years. I think one thing that will be very obvious is that gay and lesbian people, having achieved when they have, which they haven't yet, but when they do, fairly soon, I think, finally achieve full equality of civil rights in the Western world, are going to become more and more concerned about the situation of gay and lesbian people in other parts of the world for whom that journey has not yet even begun. And that's probably where the political energy of the movement, I should think, will be directed after the gay marriage fight is won. It's going to be a matter of, okay, now what can we do to help people in places like, for example, Uganda, where the concept of gay and lesbian rights probably still seems as distant, if not more so, as it did to me 40 years ago in England.
Stephen Bottrell.
Should we be telling other countries how to treat gay people? Homosexuality is illegal in 76 countries around the world, including 38 Commonwealth countries. A new organisation launches today here in the UK aimed at putting a stop to people around the world...
National Radio in Britain reporting the launch of Kaleidoscope, a charitable trust set up with the express intention of harnessing that political energy to support lesbian, gay, bisexual and transgendered individuals around the world. And all based, as the charity's director, Lance Price, acknowledges, on an assumption that the moral high ground is theirs.
It is an assumption, and it's an assumption that we make and that we have to make with enormous care and enormous caution. But if you believe, as I do, that human rights are indivisible and therefore they apply to all of us, then LGBT rights, to use the jargon, the rights of gay and lesbian people, are central to that. They can't be separated out from it. And a lot of people have expressed that view. President Obama's done it with great eloquence. He simply said LGBT rights are not individual rights, they are human rights. And it's as simple as that. It's not separate, it's about the same issue.
Indeed, President Obama has led from the front, taking on even the highly conservative US military to repeal the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy, which gay servicemen and women were obliged to sign up to. And on the 17th of June this year at the United Nations in Geneva, a resolution was adopted expressing grave concern at acts of violence and discrimination in all regions of the world committed against individuals because of their sexual orientation and gender identity. Proposed by South Africa and adopted by the narrow margin of 23 to 19, it charged the United Nations High Commissioner to produce a global report on discrimination by the end of the year. The UK ambassador to the United Nations in Geneva, Peter Goodrum, witnessed the controversial vote.
Well, the atmosphere in the council on the day in question when the resolution came to for adoption was extremely charged. The decision by the South African government to take the lead in negotiating this resolution was an extremely courageous act in the context of the United Nations and the difficulty that the UN has had in the past in getting these issues onto the agenda, in getting these issues discussed, and in getting resolutions adopted. It would be fair to say that those who voted against the resolution, the 19 countries who voted against the resolution, were overwhelmingly either from African countries or from members of the Organization of the Islamic Conference, the OIC. And South Africa itself, the South African government, obviously came in for a lot of criticism from those constituencies because it not only supported this resolution, but actually took the lead in negotiating it and in seeing through its adoption. If it had been a country like the United States or the United Kingdom, we would have come in for criticism that this was some attempt by the West or by the ex-colonial powers or whatever to impose a particular set of values on other parts of the world. And of course, that is not our view at all. These are universal human rights.
The UK's ambassador to the United Nations, Peter Goodrum. So if the United Nations is seeking to promote a universal standard of gay rights, what will that mean for the nations most resistant to that idea?
From a plain reading of Scripture, from a careful reading of Scripture, and from a critical reading of Scripture, homosexual practice has no place in God's design of creation, the continuation of the human race through procreation, or its plan of redemption,
wrote the Archbishop of Uganda, the Most Reverend Henry Luke Arombi, in 2009, when that country was debating anti-homosexuality legislation, which proposed reintroducing the death penalty for sex between men. Archbishop Arombi, and indeed our own Archbishop of Canterbury, declined our invitation to be interviewed for this programme. Hardly surprising, given the depth and intensity of feeling in the Anglican Communion on this issue. However, Archbishop Arombi did send a letter setting out the Church of Uganda's position.
Even natural law reveals that the very act of sexual intercourse is an experience of embracing the sexual other. The Church of Uganda therefore believes that homosexual practice is incompatible with Scripture.
There was also a list of recommendations in which he suggested that any change to legislation should
ensure that homosexual practice or the promotion of homosexual relations is not adopted as a human right.
Well, whatever you make of that, it does reveal how far apart people are on this issue, all occupying positions of integrity, all thinking themselves not only right, but unarguably right. I did a summer as a chaplain in a university in Uganda. I can tell you how awkward it is to try to make headway with that. And it's certainly a mistake to assume that the Conservatives are a minority in decline. Dr. Shane Gannon of Mount Royal University, Calgary, believes there are real reasons for this.
It's within the rights discourse that we think everyone should be particularly like the West. But the rights discourse is itself very much Western. The notion of rights, in some ways, this is an arguable point, but emerged in 1789 with the declarations of the, I think it's the Rights and Citizen. So this is a very Western notion. So it's not a surprise that it has to be imposed on to formerly colonial nations. The challenge becomes, how can we argue